Welcome to Business Second Opinion with Carol Sanford, a respected thought leader in the world of business design for growing people in order to grow your business. She always offers a contrarian view on what sacred temples of wisdom, such as the Harvard Business Review, advise. Her approach is based on living systems research and her four decades of practice with Fortune 500 companies and rockstar entrepreneurs. I'm Zach Swartout, and I'm your host. Today, Carol is giving a business second opinion on change management and leadership development. We're taking this from an article entitled Change Management and Leadership Development Have to Mesh by Ryan W. Quinn and Robert E. Quinn from the January 2016 issue of Harvard Business Review. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
Hi. So I know, and I want to start this conversation a little bit of a different way this week. I know you read material in a way that most of us do not. I know for myself, I read, I take in ideas, and oftentimes I do that in a way that can be pretty piecemeal. And I think a lot of us do that as well. So how do you approach reading an article like this? And how might we read it differently to not get trapped by myths of best practice?
Well, I guess one of the ways you might describe what I'm doing is I'm looking at what was clearly framing people's minds as they wrote it. We have in our heads kind of mental models that are fixed and programmed and socially conditioned. And even thoughts we have about how people can learn and change and whether they can. One of the levels of that is paradigms. We've talked about that before. But one of the things I really read for, and particularly did this week, is reading for their epistemology. Now, that's, you know, a big academic word, but it's a really, really important idea in everyday life and in a business. And epistemology really means, how do we believe that we can know something? What can we know? And most of the kind of things we know, we're only allowed to know it if our parents knew it and told us, our church told us, or if it were kings and queens or some nation view. We have a source which it comes from. And then we don't believe learning can happen any other way or that the other things are true. It like locks out and locks in what can be there for learning and what can be there for change. And that's why it's really relevant to this article, because I noticed as I was reading this particular piece by the Quinns that they are speaking from a particular epistemology. And then it occurred to me, well, there's three epistemologies people have been writing from that I've been reading. So I thought I'd offer those if that would help. I think then I can talk a little more about this particular article as you asked me questions about it.
Yeah, so, that would help immensely.
Great. Okay. The first kind of way we think that change comes about based on a particular way of understanding how change happens is that it's a project by project endeavor. Each thing that comes up, you have to work on change then. And it has to be overcome. Like, we need to change how we're doing something, like how we deal with customers or how we send invoicing or how we keep track of accounts or any number of things we're trying to do. And we're saying we need to change that. The project by project endeavor approach would mean that, well, we have to intervene and we're going to need to round up some people, probably some with a higher rank and some within the organization at a lower rank. And we're going to have to shake things up a bit. And then eventually we'll be in the new place. There's a guy named Kurt Lewin who kind of originated the articulation of this idea. And his theory was that you have to break a pattern by some pretty strong intervention. Then you have to make the change and then you get it fixed back on the other side. And then hopefully it's the way you want to be. The other thing I noticed besides the epistemology here is that's a machine worldview. You just think about that. Do people work that way? Do we actually just go shake them up and then we work on them and then suddenly they can be the new way? Well, that's not the way it works, but it is the way machines work. So you can go take something, take it apart during a retrofit of some machine. You can fix it the way it's supposed to be and then put it back. So one epistemology about how you bring about change, and it is the one that's used in this article, is that we're like a machine. The second one, and it's kind of the one that most businesses use on a more ongoing day-to-day, is the behavioral idea that if we can incentivize people and we could get something out of them, or maybe even get a few people who we incentivize and others could follow, you know, that's the idea of rewards and recognition. Show them the role models, and if they know who the role models, they'll follow them. That's an idea which, again, is not exactly how humans work, but it is, from behavioral theory, very true. And in fact, I even watch good folks who are trying to do something for the greater good will just change what they want to incentivize, not even understanding that it's an epistemology that's so outdated. The one that I work from, just so you have all three in contrast, is you build an organizational culture that is working on change as something happens moment to moment. It is not constantly forward. It is not stable, but it is something that you need to build capability of people to manage in the moment. And they need to have things to anchor to, or reference might be a better way of saying it. And I call that, and I think we've talked about that before a bit, the strategic corporate direction. Like, who are we? What are we seeking as a body of the whole? That's the corporate idea. And things could be then cycling continuously, or moving or changing. And it's not even so much then as it's just, it is more ongoing, but the idea is that it is fluid and not assumed, like Kurt Lewin did, that it's one direction. So that's the three I noticed. And you'll find me reading things from and looking for things like that. Like, I just wrote those three down when I looked at it, although they come out of things that I've already discovered.
Got it. And so really what you're seeing there is kind of the language at work that's showing you, or kind of telling you, essentially, this is kind of the paradigm that it's drawn from.
Well, in this case, the epistemology, but yes, same is true of paradigms. What I'm seeing is a combination of language and what they suggest. And when we get into what the author's premises and how they laid out doing this, I'll come back to this and reference where it was that I was seeing that. And if I forget, remind me.
Okay, well, that leads us to the next part, right? So let's dig into these premises right now. So what are the authors advocating in this piece?
Well, the authors are advocating some pretty decent things. I think that they get a little lost because they're in this epistemology of that you have to do it project by project. They're advocating that you shouldn't try and bring about change as a separate discipline or a separate set of activities from leadership development. That means then you'd have one set of people who are trying to go in, do the Kurt Lewin thing, break apart all of the stuck processes, put in place the new program, which companies buy all the time, and then suppose you're going to run that program. I mean, we've seen that with Six Sigma, with Lean. All of them are embedded in the organization. And what these folks are advocating is, in order to really divert the organization in a healthy way, rather than just kind of break it for a while, is you need to put in place some things that help move the culture and move the leaders who are going to try and lead at the same time. So that's the first premise, is let's mesh these two things. Now, how do you do that? Their second premise is that you need to simultaneously do some of that from the bottom up and from the top down. All that sounds good. I would agree you need to simultaneously work across the whole organization. What they hold in mind is the bottom up, though, is creating a task force where they are working on some change in the article. They talk about an accounting system or an audit that had to get be done for a customer in a short period of time. So they form a task force around that. But instead of just letting the task force work independently, they put those folks who are naturally going to work together, which I like. I think you need natural work teams working together. They put them into a leadership training, and they really work on trying to build the skills it's going to take. One of the things that they introduce is the idea that because you're in this leadership training or development, once you go back into the accounting organization where you're going to do this, you're going to have more tools, more skills to be able to reach out to people and find out where they are and help move the culture, because you've been through this training and now you're trained to lead this specific thing. Now, they mention a specific tool, which they gave them, a survey kind of tool. And we've talked a bit about surveys before. And this is where I really felt like they went off course with the learning and epistemological thinking. I mean, first, they do have this project thing where it's not about an ongoing process. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But they had the group who'd been in the training develop a way, a kind of an organic way that would work for the organization, and using something like a survey. Now, a survey, particularly to try and find out where people are afraid and what they're worried about and what they're seeing, does give the person interviewing some information, but it doesn't actually give any new capability to the people who are being interviewed. They tend to answer with the thoughts they've got in their mind, And they may begin to feel at least like they're heard. And I think that's the argument here, is letting people feel like they're heard. But it is not necessarily, and probably not likely, actually building their capability to think in a more whole and complete way. Now, they have the top down. So we did the bottom up, right, with this survey, and the newly trained people are engaging and helping create the change. The top down is going to sound like we usually think of when we hear the words top down, which is you have the top of the organization, the executive ranks. Look at the results they want from this project that these people have been chartered to do. Give them some really clear goals, and preferably so they can measure outcomes and the entire executive team agrees on it. So the first thing that I find interesting here is they've really got an old, not even looking at what they're saying here in terms of a hierarchical move by thinking everything at the top and the way it normally works is the way that you would bring about change. That's a very machine era thing where you have something that is the controller over the other things. Secondly, they help select the people that are going to be in this bottom up process. So they're asked to come participate. And you'll see in a moment how I'm not a big fan of people being selected and then brought in, although I like them that they're in natural teams being developed together. The leadership process that they're in, the executives help make it clear what the objectives are, what the time frame is, all the support they're going to give. And I found it curious that they even suggest that they make sure they know what the rewards are going to be from getting this done on time. Now, to me, all of this was a bit about a term I use where you're beginning to try and figure out how you're going to ameliorate all the things that might go wrong here. It's very hard for this team now to do much that can innovate because it's based on people who were selected and given something with all the boundaries already set. Now, they're allowed to use their organic creativity about how they're going to get people involved. But the process is much more one of making sure nothing gets out of bounds. So that premises, I also found pretty much an old epistemology back to the idea that the way people learn and change is based on boundaries that they're given by some arcane or fixed organization. So that's basically the ideas that I saw that they laid out in this article and the premises behind them.
Got it. So then how are you approaching this in terms of a challenge here? Like, where do the authors fall short in your view about how they considered the options based on this kind of background that you provided?
I hinted at those as I went through, so let me make them really explicit. I think they have an outdated epistemology on that learning comes from something a higher order group has figured out, either the training experts or the executives, and they put it into an organization and expect others to follow. That is from at least 600 years old, from the way churches and kings and queens worked, that there was a hierarchy of people who decided, and then they gave people some freedom to do some things at the bottom. Second thing I hinted at again is that all that can do is ameliorate the problem because the boundaries are so tightly set that there is no process for really innovating and getting something new out of it. And more importantly, they have made it so that there's very little opportunity for the people in the organization to grow. They've gotten training, which is not the same thing as personal growth. It is not the same thing as learning it. Like in my epistemology, that you want to put people on the edge of something so they're constantly having to figure out how to do something they don't yet know how to do, but they can see what a customer or a stakeholder needs. So rather than what the business needs, which is a particular kind of boundary, you're ameliorating to have the organization not get harmed. The third thing that I'm really challenged by here is that it is really externally induced and it's episodic. Now, externally induced is probably pretty obvious. Somebody at the top of the organization introduces it, fixes it, kind of defines it, does a little training with natural work teams, but pretty much it is induced as kind of an outside intervention. And then it's done episodically, which really burns out organizations where, all right, we got that one fixed. We got the deadline met on that. We got the timelines. It's really a project. We got that done and we disrupted people. But pretty soon people are distrusting. I wonder when the next thing will hit us. The hierarchy also is the fourth thing where they assume it's just fine. And I don't necessarily go get rid of hierarchies, but I radically change how they work, where you really see people more self to self rather than role to role, top to bottom, or some leader leading a group. And so I was challenged by all of those things in here and wanted to speak to them and argue with them a little bit if I ever got a chance.
Well, I know a big part of your core process is around kind of detoxing myths like this. So in this instance, how are you approaching that? And how are you starting to think through that?
So God, there's so many myths, you know, and of course, one chapter of my new book is detoxing 30 of the top most destructive myths. I've got 100 of them, but you know, you can only burden people with so many in a book. The one I see here is the idea that you have to move things from top to bottom, that you're really working with layers in order. The bridging is not between the internal part of the company and the external part of the company where customers, the market, where people live and businesses live who need you to help them. What I would want to be doing is I'd want to be bridging external. But the myth here is that it always is bridging that the top somehow understands the outside world. And they all have titles, executive titles, or maybe down as low as vice president. But usually directors are still managing internally. There are a few exceptions to that. I've seen exceptions to that in Google. But the idea is that you bridge by getting these layers of the organization connected. The second myth that is really here is this episodic thing I'm talking about is really based on a very old idea that's a manufacturing that went again, machine idea, which is that you do things in batches. You know, it used to be that you would make food products and you'd make them in a batch. And then you would put it in a jar or put it in a package, wherever it was, and you would go off to later come back and do the next batch. Organizations moved a long time ago into continuous improvement, which is kind of like the next step up. Continuous improvement realized you shouldn't be stopping a manufacturing or a production process. But to be able to go to a regenerative way of working requires to stop looking at the flow of what we produce, which is all an internal view, and go to an external view and have all of the thinking rather than this episodic batch or even the continuous improvement and start to connect to what it is that's being served in the market. So this myth that somehow you can get it all working and you can improve and finally get the perfect thing with only staying inside is the biggest myth that I see here.
We'll be right back. I want to remind everyone about how to participate in the show by joining in our quiz on SurveyMonkey each week. It's here that you can offer articles for review from HBR or other popular business-written media. Find the link at businesssecondopinion.com. It's more fun to listen when you participate. To get educated about Carol's approach to critiquing popular ideas, you can also download her chapter at businesssecondopinion.com. Plus, there's a weekly drawing for a free copy of Carol's new book, The Regenerative Business. For all those who participate in the quiz, write comments, or article recommendations, that will qualify you to be in the drawing. So, Carol, before we kind of move into some questions for this week, I wanted to really kind of dive into how you would approach something like this. So this is kind of offering an alternative is kind of where I see us being able to go here. But how do you, from a regenerative frame, approach change?
You know, it's like a radically different worldview. Most people are just saying to me, well, what can I do tomorrow? Well, the problem is we've structured organizations kind of generally, so they're in one little tinkering you could do. You know, that's like the machine paradigm. Can I tinker here? Or can I do incentives and move people? Or is there some way managers could just change how they talk to people? Well, the answer is no, it's not that simple. And that's why I had to do this recent book to try and give people more on the idea of how change works. But let me give you some hints about that. One of the things you could start tomorrow, it will take a while to produce results, but not more than 6 months. And it is to get the idea that you want to start developing people in how they think, to think more from a living systems worldview. Now, that's not the same as what most people mean by systems thinking, which comes out of the machine paradigm of Jay Forrester. But you do want to start developing people. And as the Quinn said in this article, you really want to be able to do it in a way that you put people together, working together, that actually deliver on something together. So that's one thing you can do. But the second thing is that the reason you want to do those in natural work teams is that you want them to be able to be learning and doing at the same time. So when I'm working with teams, you know, I'm an educator, I'm not a consultant. I don't go in and give people a program. My whole idea is to educate them. And the way you educate them is as important as what you educate them on. So this natural work teams, but also doing it in a way that they have something real that they're responsible for, like a particular customer or market, or we call them sometimes market field teams, where what they're doing with a particular set of customers and buyers, you start to study and think about what is the life of this business, set of businesses like, or this set of consumers like. And they're working while they're learning at the same time to invent, innovate, and come up with new ways to offer something. I call that actualizing and potentializing at the same time. You know, if you think about, if you just potentialize, educate, stayed in college, and we know kids who've done this, I think, who've stayed in college way too long. And then we say they have no real life experience. But then we look at kids who never got a good education, and it's very hard for them to climb out of not having that foundation. Some make it anyway. Some just have amazing will. But it's better if we could start, even with kids when they're young, with the way of learning is this always combining, actualizing and potentialize, learning and doing. In other words, learning on something you're going to apply it to immediately. Now, the reason for that is that gets you out of that episodic kind of thing. I'm learning in order to do something specific. It's about seeing change as a daily process and being tied to something real outside, not just market surveys or somebody telling you what you need. I laid this out in a little bit of an arbitrary way in five phases. And I call it phases because it's like phases of the moon, because they come back around. You don't do them in steps and then you're done. But I suggest that people start with doing a radically different revision in how they think about strategy, strategy education, because so much strategy is done reactively, you know, like better or worse, better than we did last year and less of some things we used to do. Or it's done based on beating the competition. It's not really based on a regenerative view of who uniquely the business is and who uniquely each market is, so you can get some kind of real connection and can engage the whole organization. I believe how you do that and put together groups to do that learning so that they're not hierarchical. They are people who have lots of energy, may take on the early strategy, which will have some fiduciary executive leaders, but it'll also have people who are union leaders, and the nature of their leadership there means they're great to have doing this. And it may be other folks who just kind of naturally always step up and either argue or offer an idea or sometimes take on something. I create that mix so you've got the whole organization learning at the same time. And a lot of it has personal development embedded in it, because you have to start that from the beginning too. We now don't really do, unless we do a mindfulness class or some kind of conflict management, it's always a separate thing. Every meeting I start has some personal development in it, always has reflection. Once I feel like I have that strategy going, and we're not only learning how to do that, but we're developing the strategy at the same time, now we've got that anchor. So now you can begin to see how you're meshing leadership development also with the ability to get a task done, to get the change that you want brought about. We've started it by the way we started strategy. We've also changed the culture just by that shift. So that's why I didn't feel favor, particularly they had, quote, top and bottom, up and down, and somehow they're supposed to meet in the middle, that the culture change needs to start from who sets the direction. Then you want to do a lot more focus on culture and begin to look at the rituals that are in place, because you need to be shifting a culture so that it becomes fluid and resilient. It isn't a one-time Kurt Lewin, break it loose and then put a new one in place. It's you want a culture that has this kind of ongoing aliveness that can change every day, not as a task assignment somewhere. And then I move in, I wouldn't want to give you every detail because it just take too long, but you have to then move into processes that change how the hierarchy works, change that people see learning and doing happening simultaneously, change that they see personal development as a part of it, and even start to ask them to make bigger and bigger commitments about what they can do for customers and consumers. All of that is culture change. It's not a separate process, but you reflect on it all the time. So I guess the last thing I'd say that are my alternatives here are that education needs to include a different way to think about things. You know, I sometimes call them critical thinking skills, but they're systemic critical thinking skills about how living systems work and what are the mental frameworks that you need to shift to. And then deep personal mastery, where groups are learning new decision-making processes together and new ways to self-manage. Then you can start to make some design changes and how work is structured, how people are paid. But all of those things are part of not creating the next thing as an episodic change, but a way to create a living, breathing, organized, instead of trying to redraw in circles how people report, it doesn't matter. What you're getting to is people are really working self to self, and they're all serving the people who decide whether they stay in business. In an overview, that's what I see as the alternative.
Got it. Thank you. So we have two questions this week, and they're more about discernment. For me, it's really about understanding, I don't know if you call it the difference between, but also so myself and our listeners could put a picture in their head of what it is that you're talking about in kind of a concrete way. So I would love some examples around the difference that you see between batch change on the ground, continuous improvement on the ground, and then a regenerative approach on the ground, and the difference between those three things. I think that would be helpful.
Sure. Let's take a retail store example. Orchard Supply, which is a company in California, if they were working on batch change approach, what they would do is they probably would identify a list of issues or restraints or challenges, something, and they would take those on one at a time as though they were unrelated to one another. And different groups would probably work on them. They might even put training in, you know, if they followed the model we have here in this particular article. If they were doing continuous improvement, what you do is, instead of them trying to find the problems and things that are going on all the time, they would say, let's look at how we're doing things and we'll get some measures, some standards of how it should look. And then let's start looking at where we could do a better continuous improvement. Where could we improve what we're doing? So both of those come off of how it is they're currently working. The batch kind of view is much more of where things are not working. The continuous improvement is building kind of on what is working along with what's not working, trying to get it to function better. When I'm talking about the kind of change I'm talking about, regenerative, it's neither of those. Both of those you can see are kind of internal. They're looking at existence. Instead, with a regenerative kind of view, you're starting with a particular customer, a particular market. So in their case, they work from a strategy that said, our essence is more about, in our corporate direction too, is more about being a good neighbor. So when they see things that are in the lives of the people who they serve in the neighborhood, like the fires in Northern California or the floods in Florida, where they have stores, what they say is, what does it mean to be a good neighbor? What do neighbors do for others? How is it we restructure what we serve while we continue to do the things we're doing? But instead of working on our internal problems, let's go look at their lives and see what it is we could. And in those particular cases, the fires and the floods, it was the problems that those people had. But they also look at, when it gets to be holiday season, what do you do to make something really work? And you may change up the store so that kids become a part of what's going on. Because when you're a neighbor, you relate to the families. So you can see there's no batching in there. There's no continuous improvement. It's off of real people, real life right now.
Got it. Now I have a very clear picture of that in my head. And so the second question that I have for you is, in this article, they talk about, I think it's plan, do, reflect. And we talked about that in kind of their approach. But you also talk about reflection. And so I wanted to make sure that we're showing the difference here in as concrete a way as possible, is the difference between those two kind of ideas.
Well, I do like the idea that they talk about reflection instead of feedback. right. So I was really excited to see that they're really, you know, was the idea of reflect. But most people are reflecting on the doing. They aren't reflecting on the thinking that caused the doing. And they aren't reflecting on even the things they considered in the thinking, much less how they were thinking. They look at the doing. And in fact, it's funny because there's a kind of a flow that would be more complete for me, which is before you begin, you reflect. Because if you don't reflect on what state you're in, what state the business is in, what state you are internally. So I often will ask people when they come in the room, what are you being reactive about today? Where is your ego stuck? And what would it take for you to get to be purposeful? Because if you don't create a process regularly, like every time people show up, starting with this inner reflection, and even somehow, how's this team working together? What happened? How have we gotten better at working together in the last 6 months? Where do we see we need to go next? You have to build that kind of reflection, which is very personal. And then you have to decide how you're going to think. And that might be my substitute for planning. I think it is a form of planning, but it's more like, how are we going to create order in this? How are we going to organize ourselves to thinking? Can we see how that contrasts to other ways we could have done it and what it might produce? now you could begin to move things, but this has a bit of a batch feel where it's like we plan it, we do it, reflect, plan, do, reflect. Whereas I think what I'm adding in is reflection is building the continuum that lets us grow as human beings. And the reflection has to not only be on what we just did, but it has to be on, in the case of Orchard Supply, how good a neighbor are they being over time? What do they know? What are they hearing back? What are they seeing? How, and their neighbors to one another. So the reflection has to be on a larger set of rings. It can't be just the plan, what we do it and reflect on us externally how we did. You got to get the inner part of the reflection working, and you got to get that part that reflects on how we're serving the community working.
That's great. Carol, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Do you want to suggest articles for Carol to review, pose questions for her to answer, or argue with her response and get a second opinion? Become a member at businesssecondopinion.com. Subscribe and review this podcast and put in a drawing to win a free copy of the book or a poster of readers' favorite quotes from the book. Also subscribe to the blog that accompanies the podcast and newsletter that will keep you up to speed on what's coming next. Join us next Thursday, where Carol and I are going to take a look at an article from July of 2017 in the Harvard Business Review entitled How to Handle a Disagreement on Your Team, all about teams and conflict. Business Second Opinion is edited, mixed, and mastered by ResonateRecordings.com. If you have a podcast or want to start a podcast, you can go to ResonateRecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free. This has been Business Second Opinion.